So here we are together reading the book of Exodus as a guide to the spiritual journey that we take when our soul feels constricted, weighed down by our day-to-day burdens. And on this spiritual journey, we follow the same mythic path as Moses, the Buddha, and of course, and especially Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. Because we reenact the experience of leaving behind the familiar for the unknown, and then we return home. And when we return home, we find home is entirely different because we have become transformed by our journey. We now experience the old and familiar in a different way. In this week's Parsha, B'Shalach, we receive instructions for making this journey, taking the first daring step into a corridor of dry land with a wall of water towering over us on either side. This journey is meant to free us from the narrow place of Mitzrayim, and to bring us to the expanded awareness symbolized by our experience at Sinai. And of course, even after this transformative experience, we'll revert to our entrenched habits and narrow ways of thinking, and we'll need to leave constriction and get lost in the wilderness over and over to return to our expansive awareness. So today we'll reflect on Parsha B'Shalach, the familiar story of the Israelites stepping into the sea as they flee from Pharaoh's army, as they leave their constricted but familiar life in Mitzrayim, which means a narrow place, abandoning all the comforts of home, which were indeed few in Mitzrayim, but still comfortingly familiar. And that may sound familiar to us, feeling like it's hard to abandon what is familiar just because the familiarity is comfortable, even though the place we're at is not good for us anymore. They have to get lost in the wilderness and follow the necessary steps of a path to liberation. And today I'd like to look at the parallels of this spiritual journey in three related strands in this same tapestry of our human existence. The three strands are Buddhist teaching about the nature of the mind, the constraints imposed by our narrow and habitual way of thinking, and the potential for liberation. The second is our meditation practice, how we experience leaving and returning, narrowness and liberation in our meditation practice. And of course, in our discussion, our lives, how we experience this cyclical process of leaving and returning in our day-to-day lives, especially as we look back and reflect on the paths we've taken. So our parsha begins. Now, when Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them the direct way. God leads them into a place where there appears to be no escape, to the edge of the sea. And God has at the same time stiffened Pharaoh's heart so that Pharaoh has sent his army bearing down on the Israelites, who are now stuck in this place where there seems to be no way out. Perhaps this metaphor, a place of no way out, speaks to us, reminding us maybe of a feeling we've had at a very low point in our lives where we could see no path forward. This is the point that Rabbi Alan Liu of blessed memory highlights in his book titled Be Still and Get Going, which is a quote from these very passages. The point at which we may feel stuck in a relationship, for example, that continues to deteriorate no matter how hard we try to make things better, or stuck in a job, he says, that's driving us into a deep depression, but we can't imagine how we'll make ends meet if we leave. We know we can't stay where we are, but we have no idea what to do. So often we panic. like the Israelites did at the edge of the sea. And here, Rabbi Lu says, Moses and God conspire us to give us a five-step program for dealing with these moments. And this is the Torah says, but Moses said to the people, don't be afraid. In other words, don't panic. Of course, you're going to feel that fear, but you don't have to run around in a panic. Al tira'u. Collect yourselves, hit yatzvu, and see uru, the salvation which Adonai will make for you today. Adonai will fight for you. Now be still, tacharishun. Eitz Chaim translates this as hold your peace or be still. And then I like that, hold your peace. Then Adonai said to Moses, why do you cry out to me? Tell the Israelites to get going, the Yisa'u. Alan Liu reflects on a commentary by Rashi about the cause of that panicky state that precedes and calls for this five-step program for dealing with fear. Right before these instructions from Moses and God, we read that the Egyptians, Mitzrayim, gave chase, vayirdfu, to the Israelites. A plural noun, the Egyptians, and a plural form of the verb for chasing. The many charioteers were bearing down. The warriors overtook them in plural form, this verb. As Pharaoh drew near, the Torah says, the Israelites caught sight of Egypt advancing upon them. And here, Egypt is referred to in the singular form, and the singular form of the verb advancing, nosea, is used. And Rashi addresses this grammatical disconnect, saying, the singular denotes that they saw not the Egyptians, but the guardian angel of Egypt coming from heaven to assist the Egyptians. Now, Rabbi Lu takes this interpretation a step further, saying the Israelites saw not the actual Egyptians, they saw their idea of Egypt. They saw the Egypt in which they had cowered as slaves for 400 years, in which they were abused and outnumbered. In other words, they saw their fear of Egypt. They saw a mental construct. And this commentary is our jumping off point for looking at parallel themes in Buddhist teaching, in meditation, and in life. I should first explain that I've been listening to a series of 8-hour-long Dharma talks by Norman Fisher on why our study of the nature of the mind can help us heal and help us decrease suffering for ourselves and others. So, as I foolishly attempt to infuse this 20-minute talk with some of those 8 hours of Dharma talks and countless hours of meditation practice, I'm sure a lot will be bewildering and impossible to understand, but don't worry about it. I just invite you to accompany me on this path of exploration of this wild wilderness territory, our minds. And perhaps Bamidbar, the wilderness in our Torah story, is just that, the wilderness of the mind. So we can explore it with Torah stories or with Dharma practice. Many philosophical, spiritual, psychological, and now neurobiological approaches alert us to the problem that we as human beings cannot see what is actually there. Rather, we see what our minds construct out of the great shifting and flowing masses of sensory inputs. Thank God we have since birth been learning, and since the Homo sapiens began to do this work, we've been learning and we've been trained to organize our world into mental constructs and to communicate about them in language. And this makes communication possible. But it also causes a lot of trouble as we constantly, without awareness, see and interpret reality in a way that reflects our deepest fears and longings. So that the Israelites did not see the Egyptian army as a group of vulnerable soldiers, who were about to get stuck in the mud and drowned in the sea, but as a mental construct of an invulnerable enemy. I suspect all of us have some example of a moment when we were terrified, only to learn that our mind had convinced us of a danger that was not really there. Or, as Mark Twain is famously quoted or misquoted as saying, who knows, "There has been much tragedy in my life. At least half of it actually happened." And yes, half of the tragedies do actually happen. Half of our fears may be realized. But even when there were real tragedies, we often discover that things do not play out exactly as we feared. Things can be terrible, but they're often terrible in a different way than we imagined. And because of this, these unanticipated circumstances call for new responses, new approaches, new perspectives that will transform us. So, not only is it impossible to see things exactly as they are, but one can even say, in Buddhist terms, that things do not exist as we think they do. People, objects, do not really have solid, separate identities, but we are in constant flux with the world within and around us. So as we embark on this journey of exploring the mind together, we have to acknowledge that we're trying to explain with words things that can't be captured in words. That's why the Zen folks always say, don't mistake the finger pointing at the moon for the moon. The words are only a way of orienting us to a path of discovering how we can live our lives with less alienation and less suffering. So at some level, we all understand that we often don't see things accurately. Psychologically, we know our expectations get in the way. Our mind fills in the blank with what we expect to see. And neurobiology and physics support this. We can only see what our human visual anatomy and physiology allow us to see. Insects with compound eyes or multiple tiny eye units perceive the world literally through different lenses. So we could say we see the world as we imagine it to be, divided up into the mental constructs we tend to agree on. Now, I would not trouble you with 4th century Indian Buddhist philosophical inquiry if it were not directly related for the potential for us to suffer less anguish, loneliness, fear, and alienation, and if it were not related to the story of the Israelites on the shore of the Sea of Reeds. Nor would I even care about this topic at all were it not for this series of talks by Norman Fisher that are on the Everyday Zen website. You could all listen to them. But listening to them, they resonated for me with the story of Exodus. So I'll try to briefly explain an approach that's described in the writings of Vasubandhu, a 4th century Indian philosopher, on the three natures of reality. The first nature of reality is called the imaginary world, the way we interpret reality, seeing Egypt bearing down on us, seeing the world through all the mental constructs that organize our perceptions into manageable chunks that we can deal with. Without sharing these constructs with each other, developed over millennia by Homo sapiens and learned by each child from the beginning of life, we would be awash in a flow of experience, colors, shapes, which William James called a big, blooming, buzzing confusion. The second nature is referred to as the dependent nature of reality, in which everything depends on and is connected to everything else. The world that our senses perceive, rather than the constructs and concepts that are the way we perceive them. I don't think we can actually know this reality, but every once in a while, with our background in meditation practice, we have a moment of recognizing the limits of our usual view of the world as separate, fragmented, unconnected things with solid identities. We have a sense that there's another way of experiencing reality. Now, this particular philosopher, unlike other Buddhist philosophers, adds on a third view of reality that is sometimes called a consummate or perfect view of reality. And I will try, if our heads don't explode first from this exercise, to explain why, in Norman Fisher's commentary, this view of reality is helpful. Norman explains that if we think, oh, I live in this world of constructs, and there is really another reality out there called the dependent reality, we would mistakenly think there's some other reality out there. And there, in fact, is not another reality that we can hope to find through meditation. This imaginary world that we live in is our reality. However, if we go on this philosophical adventure of recognizing the imaginary nature of our world and understanding that there is a basis for our perceptions that is the world, even though our constructs are imaginary, we can return to our day-to-day reality with a less rigid grip on this feeling like, I know how things are, with an awareness of interconnection, and with less fear based on our interpretation of things. The danger of spiritual practices that highlight the imaginary nature of reality is that we could dismiss the everyday world as not real or important. Instead, in working with these three natures of reality, we return to everyday reality with a perspective that has been transformed by understanding more about our minds. In Norman's words, we study these scriptures in order to understand the world in a way that can decrease suffering without abandoning those who suffer. So we study this in order to understand the world in a way that we can decrease suffering without abandoning our own suffering or the suffering of others. So as we read the book of Exodus, we can see a similar theme of leaving and returning. Moses leaves Egypt and Pharaoh and Pharaoh's palace in a moment of desperation of having to flee for his life. Only through his transformative experience of being a shepherd, spending a lot of time out in nature, watching the herd, living with Yitro and his family, only then is he able to be attuned to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh awareness and realize his mission. And once aware, he has to return to liberate the Israelites, returning to the same place he left with the new awareness that makes liberation possible. And perhaps as we continue to read the book of Exodus, we'll see more parallels and more instructions for a path to spiritual transformation. And of course, our meditation is a form of leaving and returning. So I'll close with Rabbi Lu's practice instructions from Be Still and Get Going. He writes, every day we should set aside a fixed time for leaving our usual way of being in the world, our usual consciousness, for entering a more focused and awake relationship to our existence. Every day we should leave our usual scattered mental state and center our awareness on our body and breath, breaking our habitual way of sitting and breathing by inhabiting these activities with awareness. If we are truly to make ourselves open and vulnerable, if we are to experience our life in a fresh and vibrant way, We must practice doing so every day. The crush of habit and convention is relentless. So let's just take a moment of silence before our discussion.